message this morning. I want to read to you out of this. And this one, I reference it kind of Friday, and Debbie and I have been talking about this and what it mentioned. And the reason why I want to read this one today is that to give encouragement to our young people, but to also to so that we all know and that how God has created us and made us and what he put into us and how marvelous that is. That no matter how young we are or when we are born, how God loved us so much and what he put into us and how it shows how unique and how different we all are. And that we should rejoice in that. Rejoice in who we are. Rejoice in the way that God has made us. There's so much in the world today that they want to tear that down, as far as who a person is, what their identity is, and you can change your identity that. And to me, that's detrimental. But this is what I wanted to read. And it has to do with our DNA. It says DNA has been called the most mysterious molecule in the universe. The information that it contains cannot be explained by any natural process. The sequence of chemicals on the DNA molecule is used to construct every other molecule in the human body. Yet neither the structure nor the information contained therein can be fully reproduced in a laboratory by mixing the four chemical components from which DNA is constructed. All attempts to do so have been as fruitless as trying to develop any of the 22 million books in the Library of Congress by having a monkey randomly doodle symbols on a piece of paper. Oh, they have discovered some things, that's true. But they have not unleashed all the potential that God has put in to our DNA. 1 gram, that's 0.0022 pounds of DNA. This is what, I don't know how they've discovered this, maybe by computer or what have you, but they haven't done it through thinking. It hasn't been done through evolution, but no, they may have done it by computer, but this. 1 gram, that's 0.0022 pounds of DNA they have discovered can hold as much information as 1 trillion CDs. Stated another way, this information storage system is so efficient that a microscopic speck, smaller than a dust particle, could hold a copy of every high-resolution movie ever produced, with room to spare for every movie made for the next 100 years. Isn't that amazing? As advanced as modern technology has become, mankind's greatest achievements and mighty technological advances are child's play when it is compared to that which God has produced. No human could do that. I just find that amazing. And see how unique we all are within that. That God has done that in each of us. That's why we are so unique. That's why we are all different. Contrary to what man wants to portray today, but that's why we are all different. Because of the way that God has created us. And no one, even by thinking so, can change that. We are who we are because God created us that way. All our different shapes. Yes, male, female. Skin tones, what have you. And we should go, and we should not only, we thank God for that, and we praise Him for that, that is something for us to behold, and to think positive about. To be positive about ourselves because of how God has designed and created us. Contrary to many of the things we're hearing in our world today. So I just wanted to bring that out. We turn our attention to Mark chapter 7 this morning. Now, as we discovered, and if you would read the end of Mark chapter 6 there, verses 53 through 56. People continued to gather around Jesus. They continued to flock to Him. But then in John chapter 6, we learn that the people no longer do. Not that many. But why are they gathering around Jesus? See, the last part of chapter 6 gives us a clue there. Remember, He had fed the 5,000. They crossed over. They go once again to the land of Gennesaret. He gets out of the boat, and immediately people know who He is. But why? And it says, and they ran about that whole country and began to carry here and there on their pallets those who were sick to the place they heard He was. Wherever He entered, whatever village He entered, or cities, or countryside, they were bringing the sick to Him and imploring Him that they might just touch the fringe of His cloak. And as many as touched it were being cured. So why were they all flocking to Him then? Because of the physical things that He had done. He fed them. He healed them. He did all these things. And then in John chapter 6, we learn that Jesus brings a very tough teaching. So as a result of that, His popularity begins to wane. Whilst it is true that He still has those who follow Him, especially the 12 apostles, there's not as many as before. That's why you read in John, at the end of John chapter 6, He turns to the 12 and He says, will you go away too? Will you leave me as well? And when we read that, where Peter says, where shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. They believed that much. But why did the crowds begin to leave Him? All the people begin to leave Him? Because He refused to be their type of Messiah and King. And that's exactly what we find in the 6th chapter of John's Gospel, specifically at the end of it. But now some time has now passed. That is done with. Some time has now passed, and Jesus now returns back to Capernaum. And there's still people that come around him, but not as many as before. It is now later in the summer of 29 AD. Which brings us to the 7th chapter of Mark's Gospel. And in these first 23 verses, we're going to discover another incident that Jesus has with some of the scribes and Pharisees that have come from Jerusalem. And this is a rather pointed encounter that he has with them. But it also becomes another teaching moment for those around him. And whilst it does for them, it does more so become a teaching moment for the 12. Can we pick up with the first 5 verses here? The Pharisees and some of the scribes gathered around him when they had come from Jerusalem and had seen that some of his disciples were eating their bread with impure hands, that is, unclean hands. That is, unwashed. And then Mark gives us a little parenthesis there. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they carefully wash their hands, observing the traditions of the elders. And from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they cleanse themselves. And there are many other things which they have received in order to observe, such as the washing of cups and pitchers and copper pots. The Pharisees and the scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat their bread with impure hands?" Rather pointed question, do you not think? These scribes and Pharisees who come from Jerusalem, they are looking for anything to nail Jesus on. Anything they can get him on. And as we learned earlier, if you read back in Mark chapter 3, if you remember earlier, it is because of what Jesus had done and what he had said about them. And we know from Mark chapter 3 that they had come to the conclusion and decided that they had to do something about him. In fact, to do away with him. So now they're looking for anything that gives them a chance to do just that. And they think they found it. And they're going to use his disciples to that end. Now again, it's important to look at the parallel passage, which is found in Matthew chapter 15, verses 1 through 20. So Mark gives his take on things and Matthew gives his take on things. And whilst they do that, you will not find this incident in John nor in Luke. It's just found in Matthew and Mark. As to why, we need to remind ourselves that the gospel writers have their reasons for what they have written. They are not copying one another. Each one has a purpose for what they are writing concerning the life of Christ. Which brings us back to the text. And if you would, look at Matthew 15 as well. Now, Mark puts some things before that Matthew puts a little later. But Mark is doing this for a purpose. And again, keep in mind who he's writing to. He's writing to Christians in Rome who are going through a tough time. So he wants them to be aware of these things, specifically of how people think about others and how they might be thinking among themselves about one another, as well as about others. So Mark puts this in here. Now, we know that Mark has gotten his information from Peter. But here's the criticism. The religious leaders, the scribes, the Pharisees from Jerusalem criticize Jesus about his disciples. Notice, they do not say that Jesus has done this. They don't pick on Jesus in so many words. They don't directly. They pick on his disciples. But indirectly, they're picking on him. Because how they see Jesus is he's a rabbi, a teacher. These are his disciples. He should have control over his disciples and what they do. So they very pointedly say, why do your disciples do this? They do not observe the traditions of the elders. Notice they don't say anything about the law of Moses. They say they do not walk according to the traditions of the elders. They are eating with impure, unclean hands. They had not wash them. I like what my friend and colleague, ministerial colleague Steve Crane says concerning this when he said that the scribes and Pharisees, the religious leaders of Jesus' day, they are so intent on keeping the law, that would be the law of Moses, they are so intent on keeping the law that they have built laws around the laws in order not to break the law. Now wrap your head around that. That's in effect what they have done. But see, what this goes back to is this. Exodus chapter 30, verse 19, and Exodus 40, verse 13. Look at what that says. Exodus 30, verse 19. Now notice what the Lord spoke to Moses. Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands and their feet from it. When they enter the tent of meeting, they shall wash with water so that they will not die. Or when they approach the altar to minister by offering up in smoke a fire to the Lord. So they shall wash their hands and their feet, so that they will not die. And it shall be a perpetual statute for them, for Aaron and his descendants throughout their generations. And then Exodus chapter 40, verse 13. Let's actually look at verses 11 through 13 of 40. You shall anoint the laver and its stand and consecrate it. Then you shall bring Aaron and his sons to the doorway of the tent of meeting and wash them with water. And you shall put the holy garments on Aaron and anoint him and consecrate him that he may minister as a priest to me. See, it goes back to that. But note, this was meant for Aaron and his sons. This was meant for the priest, for the Levitical priest. That's what they were to do. What's that, Jeff? Yes. However, when you read this, what you see is it was not for everyone. It was for the priest, and specifically for the high priest, for Aaron and his descendants. However, it was expanded. And according to the traditions of the elders, it was expanded to include everyone. Not just the priest. But not just to wash before you go into the tent of meeting. But to wash your hands, you were unclean even before you would eat or do anything. R.C. Foster brings out that the traditions of the elders, what you have to understand about the traditions of the elders, the traditions of the elders were their oral interpretation of the Old Testament, which famous teachers such as Hillel, Shammai and others had laid down through succeeding generations. But now these were not committed to writing, they were oral. They were not committed to writing until 185 AD, when at Tiberias, by the Sea of Galilee, the Jewish rabbis began the writing of what is known today as the Mishnah. And there is a whole tract. What that means, there's a whole chapter just dealing with the washing of hands. It has to do with that. Now, here's what the scribes and Pharisees were talking about. The Messianic Jew, many years ago in the 19th century, Alfred Edersheim, talked about that. And this is what he says. In fact, there's an entire tract of the Mishnah called the Yadim, which means hands, which was devoted to ritual cleansing before each meal. And some rabbis added after the meal as well, that one was required to pour a minimum of a quarter of a log. And a quarter of a log to the Jews was half an eggshell. Okay, half an eggshell of water over the hand. This is what the scribes and Pharisees are talking about that Jesus' disciples did not do. Edersheim goes on to say, they were very specific. The water was poured on both hands. The water was poured on both hands, which must be free of anything covering them, such as gravel, mortar, etc. The hands were lifted up, so as to make the water run to the wrist. In order to ensure that the whole hand was washed and that the water polluted, now get this, and the water polluted by the hand did not again run down the fingers. Then, similarly, each hand was rubbed with the other. And the word that is used in the text, as we'll see, the word that is used there means to be used with the fist. Each hand was rubbed with the other, with the fist, provided the hand that had rubbed had been effused. Otherwise, the rubbing might be done against the head or even against a wall if the hands were defiled. If the hands were defiled, two effusions were required. The first, or first waters, to remove the defilement. And the second, or after waters, to wash away the waters that had contracted the defilement of the hands. Accordingly, on the effusion of the first waters, the hands were elevated, and the water made to run down at the wrist, while at the second waters, the hands were depressed so that the water might run off by the finger point and the tips. See all that? That's what they had to do before their hands were considered clean to eat. I like how the Scottish scholar William Barclay puts it into layman's terms for us. Before every meal and between each of the courses, the hands had to be washed, and they had to be washed in a certain way. The hands, to begin with, had to be free of any coating of sand or gravel or any such substance. The water for washing had to be kept in special large stone jars so that it might be certain that it had been used for no other purpose and that nothing had fallen into it or had been mixed with it. So first the hands were held with the fingertips pointing upwards. The water was poured over them and must run at least down to the wrist. The minimum amount of water, as I said, was 1/4 of a log. That is half of an eggshell. And while the hands were still wet, each hand had to be cleansed with the fist of the other one. That is what the phrase about using the fist means. The fist of one hand was rubbed into the palm and against the surface of the other. This meant that at this stage, the hands were wet with water. But that water was now itself unclean. That's the first waters, because it touched the unclean hands. So second, the hands had to be held with fingertips pointing downwards. First pointing upwards, then pointing downwards. And the water had to be poured over them in such a way that it began at the wrist and it ran off at the fingertips. After all that had been done, then and only then were the hands pronounced clean. So the scribes and Pharisees see Jesus' disciples, and they haven't done that. They're eating with unclean hands. That's what they're complaining about. Now, here's the thing, brothers and sisters. There's nothing inherently wrong with traditions, is there? Are there? Not inherently. Unless they are used in the way the scribes and Pharisees of Jesus' day used them. I like what Brother Nofus Dayton had to say concerning this. He says, we are all the result of and work with what others have handed down to us. But there is something terribly wrong when traditions control our worship, our flexibility or inflexibility, our acceptance or rejection of people, our ministries, our plans, our programs, our relationships, our grace, our attitudes, our priorities, our openness or closeness, and our growth or lack of growth. When traditions stand in the way of our being God's ambassadors to people in need, then those traditions have lost their usefulness. And I believe he is correct. And there's a lesson there for us. I can give you two illustrations from past ministry. My first ministry years ago, I'll never forget it. Debbie probably remembers it too. And we're talking about traditions, right? The Church of Christ that I preached at near Goldendale, Washington. There were two sets of pews when you walked in. But each person believed they had their own pew to sit in. It was like in the old days where in the 17th, 18th century, people would actually rent a pew. Or they would pay for their pew, and that's where they would sit and their family would sit. Well, it's kind of like that in this church. When I went there, not very many people were there. Started calling around. In this little town, if you count the cats and dogs, there might have been 60. And then when I first went there, there wasn't maybe a dozen people or so. And I began to call around all in the area. People began to come. I had a new family come in. This new family came in, and they sat down in the pew. Right before service started, one of the elders' wives came up to this pew and saw these people sitting there. And she looked at him and said, "Excuse me," didn't say hi, didn't say, you know, glad you're here, good morning, glad you're here, glad to have you, nothing like that. She said, "Excuse me, you're sitting in our pew." The husband looked up at her and said, "Excuse me, we're new here, we just came in, we just sat down." She said, "Well, you will have to leave and get up and sit in another pew because this is our pew." And he said, "Excuse me, is your name on it?" And she said, cleared her throat, and she said, "Well, if you would like to know, yes, it is." So they got up, and she pointed and said, "This is so-and-so's pew. Their family's name was on it." So this family, I saw this, I heard it, got up, and they went to a different, you know, sat down a different place. But can you imagine what they thought about that? Traditions. Another one more example. I ministered in the church in Oregon, in Southern Oregon. We had some new people come in, new families come in. Debbie and this younger, one of the young ladies, they wanted to have a Valentine's banquet for the mothers, you know, and for the couples, for young families, because we were getting young families in. And so they planned on doing it. They were politely told, it's minister's wife now, you know, they were politely told, "You cannot do that unless we tell you you can." And they were politely told that the kitchen area did not belong to them. And one of the ladies in the church who told them that said, and this young lady said, "What do you mean?" She said, "You cannot do anything in this kitchen, anything in this area, unless we give you permission. Because, see, it does not belong to you." And she said, "Excuse me?" And she went over to where the kitchen area is, the, I don't know what you call it, island or whatever it is. And she pointed to it, and she told them, "You see whose name this is? This belongs to the ladies of this church." And it's like, well, Debbie's going, well, who are we? Are we not? But no, see, they consider them not to be. Because their names were not on there. Traditions? To have young people told that, well, yes, you can minister in this church, but you have to minister and you have to do things the way we want it done. We'll give you permission if you come on board with us and do things what we want, our way. And think how that makes people feel. Well, see, this is what was going on here with Jesus and his disciples. So that brings us back to our text next. Jesus doesn't let it go. Look at what he says. And he said to them, "Rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites. As it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far away from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men, neglecting the commandment of God. You hold to the tradition of men." That's the tradition of the elders. So first thing right off the bat, Jesus said, calls them hypocrites. That comes from the Greek. And it was specifically used for a play actor. Because back in those days, the actor would use different masks for each part. And he would hold it up to his face. So you couldn't see what his real face looked like, but he would hold that mask up to his face as he played his part. And it literally means false face or two-faced. You ever heard that word before? She or he is two-faced. Well, what do you think that comes from? A lot of things people use today and have used in the past come from the Bible. It means putting on a false front for people. And that's what Jesus said the scribes and Pharisees were doing. And that's why next he quotes from Isaiah chapter 29, verse 13, which is from the Septuagint, which had to do with the Jews of Israel in Isaiah's day, the Jews of Israel, their current behavior and actions. Isaiah was saying, you do these things outwardly, but you don't really worship God. You really neglect Him. And Jesus is comparing the religious leaders to this. Now notice this something here, brothers and sisters. Jesus did not deny what His disciples were doing. He doesn't excuse what they were doing. He did not try to excuse their behavior. Nor did he, contrary to what many people think, he did not set aside the law as such. The law of what Moses said. His response points to the fact that they did not have to, what he's saying, that they did not have to keep the traditions of the Pharisees. But now at this time, and that's why Mark puts it in parentheses, Jesus did not set aside the law as far as unclean or clean food. That came later. That did not happen until the early church was started. But notice here, Jesus does not stop there. He gives them an illustration to bring home the point concerning them. And here's the thing. He is being very sarcastic with them. Notice what he says. He quotes Isaiah. They honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain they worship me, teaching us doctrines, the precepts of men. Neglecting the commandment of God, you hold to the tradition of men. And he was also saying to them, he's pointing out the scribes and Pharisees. Notice what he says. You are experts. He's being sarcastic. You are experts at setting aside the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition. Your tradition. Notice Jesus doesn't say law of Moses. He says your tradition. For Moses said, he's giving them an illustration of what they do. He knows what they do. And Jesus might not know these scribes and Pharisees, you know, their names or what have you. Or at least they think they don't know that he knows who they are. But he does. He says, for Moses said, honor your father and your mother. And he who speaks evil of father or mother is to be put to death. But you say, if a man says to his father or his mother, whatever I have that would help you is Corban, that is to say, given to God, you no longer permit him to do anything for father or mother, thus invalidating the word of God by your tradition which you have handed down. And you do many things such as that. You see what Jesus is driving at there? The Lord gives him scripture again, this time from one of the Ten Commandments. Now this commandment, people think that it pertains to your children from the time they're little till they grow up. But when God said through Moses that handed this commandment down, honor your father and your mother, for it will go well with you if you do. And then what Jesus quoted from Exodus chapter 21:17 about that he who speaks evil of father or mother is to be put to death. He quoted again the scripture form. This specifically pertained to adult children. What God was saying to them was that I want you to take care of your parents. Honor your father and your mother. It's not just from the time that you're little when you grow up. But back in Moses' day, who took care of the elderly? Who should take care of the elderly? God was saying, adult children. You honor them. You take care of them. So Jesus then cites their tradition of Corban. Now Corban, what it came to mean was a gift or offering to God. In other words, one could label something as Corban, which meant you promised to give it to God. It could be anything. It could be property. It could be a house. It could be money. Anything. And in declaring it that way, by saying, this is Corbin, you could not sell it or give it to anyone. And that meant even one's parents. I mean, whatever you had, you could say, this is Corbin. However, the catch was this. You could say it was Corbin. It was given to God. So if you need to take care of your parents and your parents knew that, you could say, sorry, Mom, Dad, this is Corbin. I'm sorry, I can't help you out. I wish I could take care of you. You know, I wish I could give you this, but I can't do it. Because, see, I've already declared this Corbin. And since it's been declared as Corbin, it's given to God. But here's the catch. This is what they did. Really diabolical in my mind. And Jesus knew this, and this is what he's talking about. You yourself, even though you claimed it as Corbin, you yourself could still use it. See? Yeah, I've declared it Corbin, it's a gift to God, but I can still use it. See how that works? Then when you died, it could be given to God in some way. But your parents might already be dead. But it didn't matter. You declared it as Corbin. So after all, I can't take care of my parents because I declared this as Corbin. But I can still use it however I want. This is just not for my parents. Because see, I've declared it as Corbin. As long as I've declared it as Corbin, I can't do anything with it for anybody else. But I can still use it. So Jesus was saying they did that very thing, but did not take care of their parents. That's why he quoted to him Exodus 21:17, that if you didn't honor your father and mother and you spoke evil of them, they would be put to death. He's very pointed to them about that. And as Brother Satan says, Jesus' response to the Pharisees and scribes made it clear. And this is a teaching lesson for us, brothers and sisters, that we need to get through to us, ourselves, and to others. That Jesus' response to the Pharisees and scribes made it clear that he refused to see people and relate to people according to the tradition of the elders, to the precepts of men. He would not allow, as Brother Satan says, allow the glasses they had to blur the vision he had of people. And after all, why? Because Jesus' vision of people was God's vision of people. And isn't that the vision of people that we should have? That's what Jesus was teaching his disciples. That's a teaching moment for us. How? See, that the Lord wants us to view people and not get hung up with things that obscure that. And you see, that's what happened with the scribes and Pharisees. And see, here's the thing. We're going to sing that the song, Victory in Jesus. And here's the thing. You see, that's what Jesus wanted. Jesus wanted people to be victorious over those things. Jesus wanted people to have victory. But victory over the things of man and victory in God. And that's why he ultimately came, of course. And that's why we sing this, because it's victory in Him that counts.